We always gather people from all sorts of sectors, from the, of course, academic and business and government, philanthropy. You know, there are very few places in Chicago where you all those sectors convene and converge to look to further the city. And here at City Club, it's what we do best. So we've had a busy week this week. We talked about arts and infrastructure in the DNC on Monday. And of course, on Friday, we have Joe Kennedy. I think we do still have a few seats for that. He's President Biden's special envoy to Northern Ireland. But I get especially excited when I see this Crown Family School banner when I come in the room, because you just know you're in for some real content. And like the name of the school, it's not just the speakers and the conversation that we have, but it's actually resulting in solutions that can be implemented and that will make Chicago better and bring Chicago back to the lead where other cities follow what we're doing. And so much of that comes out of University of Chicago and the things that we talk about here at City Club. So thank you. Adrian and I talk about this regularly, so I want to thank the Crown Family School, Adrian Talbot, Dean Gorman-Smith, you know, for your continued partnership. We've had some great conversations around guaranteed income, mental health, new arrivals, migrant situation, and of course, education at all levels. And there's so much more to come. This partnership has really made a difference at a time when our city needs it most. So thank you, Adrian. Thank you, Deb. Thank you to the entire University of Chicago, especially the Crown Family School. Please keep those ideas coming. There's so much more to come. So with that, I'm going to introduce Deborah Gorman-Smith, who's the Dean and Emily Klein Gidwitz Professor of the Crown Family School of Social Work. Deb's a little easier, but I'm Deborah Gorman-Smith, the Dean and Emily Klein Gidwitz Professor of the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice. She is the Principal Investigator and Director of the Chicago Center for Youth Violence Prevention, and she's going to open today's conversation. She's obviously a great partner of the City Club of Chicago, and she's going to introduce the rest of our panel, as she knows each of them far better than I do. There are some brilliant people that are in the room today. So please join me in welcoming back to City Club of Chicago, Dean Gorman-Smith.
I'll help you up if you need it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. As you've heard, I'm Deborah Gorman-Smith. I am proud to be the Dean of the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. And it is always a pleasure to be in this room, to look out and see so many partners, and also to look out and see so many alum of the Crown Family School, many of whom are alum when it was called the School of Social Service Administration, or SSA. So as you've heard, this conversation today is part of a series of events co-hosted by Crown and the City Club of Chicago. These events are intended to bring civic leaders, academics, and community members together for open and inclusive conversations so that we can build a stronger and more vibrant Chicago. Through this series, we hope to share ideas about social issues and innovations and explore the ways that we can work to solve big problems together using research, evidence-based policies, and, as you heard, direct action. I want to thank Dan, Jackie, Amanda, and the entire City Club team for their partnership around this series and for creating this space where we can engage in productive conversations about these really important issues. Home ownership in Chicago and across the country remains the principal way that most households build wealth. Despite this, the gap in home ownership rates between minority households and white households is pronounced, even bigger today than in years past when it was perfectly legal to refuse selling someone a home based on race or skin color. Closing this growing racial ownership gap requires intentional, evidence-based policymaking and strategies informed by wisdom and energy from all sectors. Today's conversation stems from a partnership between the Crown Family School, our faculty and students, and the City of Chicago. Through this partnership and today's conversation, we want to explore and share strategies that our city might consider to help reduce the barriers that inhibit home ownership and wealth building for households of color. Guided by thoughtful research and with all of your help, because it does take all of us, we can create solutions that enrich our neighborhoods, uplift lives, and help change conditions so we can all thrive. So thank you again for joining us today and for your interest in this topic. With that, I'm going to hand the mic over to WBEZ reporter Erin Allen, who will introduce our speakers and moderate today's conversation. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Deborah. I do want to start off just by piggybacking off of that context a little bit and repeat this this quote that came from the Urban Institute: "The gap in the home ownership rate between Black and White families in the U.S. is bigger today than it was when it was legal to refuse to sell someone a home because of the color of their skin." So that's pretty significant. Things have evolved over time in different directions. There's been the Fair Housing Act, redlining, market crash of 08, which affected Black homeowners more than others. Very much an ebb and flow here. The Crown Family School decided to conduct a study to see what could be done to address some of these disparities in Chicago. That study is called Strategies for Addressing the Racial Gap, Racial Wealth Gap Through Housing Policies and Other Approaches. So, just wanted to provide that context and give you all a bit of a more of a sense of why we're all here today. So let's get some introductions going. Hey, y'all.
Hi.
How, am I, like, I had some food before this. Am I good? Like, are my teeth clean? Okay, thank you. All right, so first off, we have Chicago Department of Housing Commissioner Lisette Castaneda. Commissioner Castaneda, welcome. I'm going to keep these short because we all know who these folks are, and we don't have a lot of time, unfortunately. So, Commissioner Castaneda has a couple decades in the game. So happy to have you here today.
Thank you.
Also, we have Rob Chaskin, PhD. Welcome. Rob is a professor in the graduate program in health administration and policy through the Crown Family School at the University of Chicago. Rob's research is national, it's international, and it's very local right here in Chicago as well. So thank you for being here. And Marisa Navarra, former Chicago Department of Housing Commissioner, serving right before Commissioner Castaneda, but right now she's the Vice President of the Community Impact Vice President of Community Impact at the Chicago Community Trust. Marisa, thank you so much for being here. Okay, so I'm going to transition smoothly to this this seat right here. Hopefully I got a mic mic'd up. So I want to start the conversation off just by setting that tone a little bit more. Rob or Marisa, if you could talk about setting up this report. What were the circumstances and context that we were in here in Chicago that made this report come about? Marisa, maybe you can start.
Sure. What's interesting about the crew that's arranged here is this started when I was at the City Department of Housing, and we were in some conversations with Adrian at Crown School about how we could work more closely together. I am an alum of the program and had a lot of interest in figuring out how we could be closely aligned. And one of the things that we have been struggling with for a long time, as many have, is the gap in the ways that homeownership shows up as a wealth builder for white Americans as compared to the way it does for Black and Latina Americans, and in our case, Chicagoans. And so when we started a conversation with Crown School about ways that we could work together, this was a topic that came up, and we said, you know, if there's something that you can help us understand about what's going on around the country that we haven't had a chance to learn about and know about, we would love to know more because we have got to be doing more. And that's really the impetus.
Yeah, thank you. Rob, can you talk about what you were interested in learning in this report? Where did you look? What did the study do? What didn't it do?
So I feel like I'm very loud. Okay. We were basically tasked with this notion of trying to figure out this racial wealth gap. We took a little bit of a broader approach than just focusing on home ownership. Home ownership obviously is the main driver for intergenerational wealth building in the U.S., but particularly for lower-income individuals and people of color, it's not always the best choice, right? It's risky, it's expensive. The foreclosure crisis, I think, opened up a window to all of us to understand that it's not a panacea. And so we just try to take a broad look at strategies that are being employed in municipalities across the country and to some extent in other countries as well about what was being tried on the policy front and what evidence, if any, there was about how these different strategies were having an impact. So we took a multi-pronged approach. Basically, we did a broad literature review looking at academic and policy literatures. We consulted with a number of people in the field, both academics, housing policy people, and people working on the ground. And we focused our organizer report around a few different sort of dimensions. One focused on efforts to support home ownership, both for individual households and also looking at collective ownership models. We also looked at strategies that were intended to increase the supply of affordable housing, whether owned or rent, because although it may not be there may not be as direct a line between being in an affordable and stable home, but renting and wealth building, it's a foundation, right? And without that foundation, it's very, very difficult to keep make ends meet, let alone have any kind of economic and social mobility.
Yeah.
And then finally, we looked at some broader asset building strategies that were really focused on building assets for families and households, some of which are connected to housing policy, and others really not at all, just really focused on the finances and how to begin to increase the financial well-being of poor households.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. As you said, some of the report really focused on folks who want to be homeowners, who have that aspiration. Some of it focused on people who may not find that accessible. For the people, Marisa, who do end up wanting to become homeowners, what are some of the practices that came through in this study that could work here in Chicago?
Mm-hmm. Some of the things I would like to highlight, some of them are could work and some are like are working and are kind of nascent, right? So it was cool to see. We learned, I flagged a bunch of things to dig in deeper on because I feel like we're a little more nascent on some of them. So a couple examples. One that you talked about was shared ownership. And I think that's a really important concept in a lot of Chicago communities. When I was still at the city, we were able to support the Pilsen Housing Cooperative to purchase a six unit building, bringing their total number to 18. So they've been at it for a bit now. And the benefit there, it's a shared ownership model. It's a limited equity shared model. And people, if you think about what's happening in Pilsen, the ability for a longtime Pilsen resident to buy a single family home on a single lot with a 30-year mortgage has left the station. This is a way for people who are concerned about their ability to stay in this community to be able to own something, to build wealth, and be able to stay put in their community. So it's something we're very interested in. This interest carries on through the trust. We're interested in figuring out how to support more shared ownership models like that that can get to lower incomes than we can get to with a single family home and really get at some communities where that challenge exists deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Another one I'll point to that's in the report is modular housing as a way to lower costs. So when I first started as housing commissioner, we kind of bet on that as and at the time the costs were about the same as stick built, and our hope was that if we invested in that work and really supported it, that over time the costs would come down, and now they have. So we are seeing that work. There's different groups even here today, United Power and Connected Capital and Communities, that are working with modular housing, and it is something that is bringing the costs down, and you can do the work year round, which is great in Chicago. One last one that I'll point to that the report talks about is alternatives to credit scores when looking at getting people into mortgages. Hugely, hugely important. That is such a barrier for a lot of people. And the reality is that lots of folks have lots of credit. It just might not show up in a traditional credit score. So if you've been paying your rent, if you've been paying your utilities, can we find a different way to track that, so that we can get people into non-predatory mortgage loans that can get them the kind of, you know, presence in a community that they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I know there are some banks in the room right now that are looking into that, and we want to encourage that.
Mm-hmm. I know the study looked all over the country. I'm curious, Rob, having done the study, is there anything you would add to that?
I think the only thing I might add is to call attention to the sort of inequities in property tax assessment. Mm-hmm. So particularly black households tend to be assessed at much higher rates, and their properties tend to sell for much less. So I'm not exactly sure what's behind those disparities, but that's something I think we can look at. I also think, you know, there are other aspects of this, or just more support, for example, for home repair, for lower income homeowners, and possibly things like deferred property tax payments. Uh-huh. So, you know, you pay your property taxes upon the sale of your home rather than annually. That's a little risky and dangerous, obviously, because you need to be able to have a savings plan in place. Mm-hmm. And so you could also think about combining more direct asset building components, like matched savings accounts or something like that, to support those assets.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Commissioner Castaneda.
Hey.
So I know Mayor Brandon Johnson has set out some priorities for expanding homeownership in Chicago's communities, especially the ones that are the most disinvested in. As you're listening to this and with your familiarity with the study that has been done, how do these recommendations compare to the goals set out in that executive order?
I think that the big thing that I took away from the report, and that I think for practitioners in the room we've kind of known, right, is that housing is an entire spectrum, right? You have to look at it from all the way from, can you even be a renter? Are you in a situation where your housing is unstable? All the way through renters, because again, you cannot buy a home if you don't have savings. You can't get savings if you are paying 70-80% of your income towards rent. And then from there, when we talk about homeowners, it's not enough to just say, we help you get into this house. It has to be, how do we help you keep this house and let you make the choice on what you want to do with your home? Do you want to sell it? Do you want to pass it on? Do you want to die in the house and be buried there? Like, great. Like, then that's the thing that should be available to you. And so, for example, one of the things that just happened, and I know all of you in the room are aware, that just a couple of weeks ago now, Mayor Johnson's Housing and Economic Development bond was passed by City Council, and we're really very, very excited. Please applaud. It was so much work. So that's $1.25 billion to be split equally between the Department of Housing and the Department of Planning and Development. And when you look at the plan for the bond in housing, it follows the spectrum, and it follows a lot of the things that we're talking about here today, right? So it is investing in our multifamily pipeline and making sure that we can get these projects that are kind of ready to go, except for the fact that they need money, out into the world. It's about making sure that we have some sort of down payment assistance program that really does work work for folks, right? How do we address some of these things where it's just like, I could, but maybe I just need that extra little bit to help with the down payment. It's also more money for home repairs. We currently have three separate programs that we are working on home repairs. There's our small accessible repairs for seniors program. There is our home repair program, previously known as the roof and porch program. That's what everybody knows it as. And then even now with our last bond issuance from the Chicago Recovery Plan, we are now rolling out our Green Homes Chicago, which is retrofits for single families to be able to do some decarb work in their homes. Again, also talking about longevity and being able to keep costs down. And so all of the things that are in the report are in some way being worked on. Some of them are, as Marisa said, nascent, right? We're looking at policies. We're looking at what are the things that need to be changed. And some of them are like, okay, we're just going to put some money out on the streets and help folks get to where they need to be.
Yeah. You mentioned the recent initiative by Mayor Brandon Johnson. I wonder if there's something, including that or besides that, that you can kind of pull out and say, this is really what is, in my heart of hearts, exciting to be working on right now.
It has been a very joyful, honestly, 3 months. Like there have been some hard days, don't get me wrong. But I have definitely found a whole lot of work that we are doing, particularly honestly in the policy space, right? Where we're looking at what are the root causes of some of these things, right? Because we do want to get the money out there. You want to look at home repairs, but even things like the appraisal gap, right? Like, how do we address that? And again, talking about really nascent stages, but that is one of the conversations that we're having, which is how do we affect policy and what is the thing that we deploy out onto the streets so that as we're talking about that accessibility to home ownership, it's again, not just did we get you in the house, is when you're ready to refinance, are you able to do that? When you want to use equity from your home to make improvements, are you able to do that? And these things all need things like an appraisal, right? And so we know that in Black and Brown communities, the appraisal gap is huge. So we're looking at those sort of things to really say, how do we get at the root of this?
Mm-hmm. Marisa, we can kind of talk about what the city can do until we're blue in the face, but where may be some gaps, right? And I'm wondering what areas philanthropy mm-hmm. can step in, especially with you and your role with the trust.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. There's an effort that we're about to pilot that I am excited about. I mentioned Connecting Capital and Community, or 3C, and that's with significant. It's housed at the trust, but it's with significant support from JPMorgan Chase, and they've been busy at focused on East Garfield Park and Humboldt Park for a couple of years now, and we're about to pilot a mortgage loan at 3.5%, no private mortgage insurance. And the in this day and age, that's a massive drop in the interest, right? And it's coupled with a massive attention to developing a pipeline of buyers who are ready for that moment. I want to recognize our partner in that, Neighborhood Housing Services. And important role for philanthropy is we need to be able to create the space to take some risks and try some things and learn, because it's very hard with public money to do that. You've got to already know it works if you're going to put taxpayer dollars on the line, right? So we need to be trying this and seeing what works. And then it's not just a role for philanthropy. I would broaden that to a role for the private sector, because we need investors and banks to actually buy these securitized loans on the secondary market so that Neighborhood Lending Services can keep recycling the capital in a very thoughtful way. So this is what we can do as philanthropy, and this is what others can do to help make this kind of trial work and see what we learn from it, and then hopefully scale it and do much more going forward once we've kind of kicked the tires and learned what we need to learn from it. I think that's one important example. We have a massive gap, frankly, just in what it costs to build in this city and what a family of four. So if you look at like a measure like 80% of the area median income, that's about $90,000 for a family of four. The gap between what they can afford to buy and what the product that's out on the street is about $160,000. That's a huge gap that Down payment assistance, which the city does have, can help with, but that's not the only solution. Mm-hmm. Making it cheaper to build, which the city's working on with Cut the Tape, is part of the solution. Using modular is part of the solution. Getting the rates down on the loans is part of the solution, right? It's not one thing. And so there's a lot of ways to try to get at that. The one other thing I'll say really quickly, because I think this doesn't tend to come up in a homeownership conversation, is zoning. And so we have in this city a whole bunch of parts of the city on the north side that are within a half mile of transit where the only thing you can build is a single family home on a minimum 25 by 125 lot, which is... you know, a pretty clear way of saying there's only a certain kind of household that can live in this area. And generally speaking, if you're in a lot of these neighborhoods, if your household income is less than $500,000, it's off limits to you. And so one of the things that we tried to do when I was at the city was to change that to say that you could have the right to build up to a three flat if you're in an area within that close to transit. The difference that could make is, you know, if even if you think about a three-flat condo, you're now cutting that cost to be an owner in that community substantially. Mm-hmm. And it matters to me, and I think it should matter to all of us, that we have communities that are accessible to a range of incomes all over this city. So we have a new city council. We have a new housing commissioner. So the hope is we'll come back to that law and get it done this time. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I do, before we get to the next question, want to let you know that there is a blue piece of paper on your table. Everyone should have access to that.
It's like a
that is where you can write a question. We will have time for like maybe two. So, you know, best of luck. but you can, if you have a question, you can write it down on paper and wave it for one of the City Club staff to grab that from you. All right. Rob, I know that a lot of what you covered in this study and a lot of what all of you think about respectively in your work is homeownership, but also renters, right? People who are not, for whom that's not accessible. Can you talk about some supports for renters that came up? What are some of those that could work in the city?
I will leave the question of what will work in the city to my colleagues to my left, because they will know that better. But I think a couple of things to think. First of all, we just need more affordable housing. I mean, that's just foundational, and we have to figure out how to make that happen. Mm-hmm. We have land, there are delinquent properties, we have, you know, so increasing numbers of vouchers, for example, or other ways of subsidizing housing. I know the... you know, public housing is a touchy situation in the U.S. and probably is a political non-starter. But I think there may be ways to think about, you know, publicly provided and subsidized housing that work. So those are some things to think about. I think there are a lot of delinquent properties in the city, you know, tax delinquent properties that. You know, are moved onto into the land bank or into city ownership. I think there's a disposition. There may be a disposition question there. That is how we think about putting those properties back online that prioritize affordability, which I'm not sure is part of the calculus at the moment. Is another thing to think about. Zoning changes, I think, are really, really important to be able to allow for more density, as Marissa was talking about. We have an inclusionary zoning policy. I think it could be more robust. I think we could think about trying to reach down to lower percentages of AMI and higher percentages of units in new developments, and maybe, close off developer options to not do that, right? So I think they can still, there's a fund they can pay into for affordable housing, but that's not the same as trying to integrate affordable housing into new developments.
Yeah.
And then I think finally, maybe finally, is, another thing that's sort of difficult to talk about is rent stabilization, because it's there's state law that prohibits it in Illinois municipalities. But that's, I think that might be an advocacy target.
Mm-hmm. Rent stabilization, can you clarify?
So ways of capping the amount that landlords can increase the rent in any given year.
Got right? you.
Rent
control. Rent stabilization. I think the modular design, new ways of thinking about constructing that can be made more cheaply, and if you change zoning laws so that you can put modular housing in higher density in places where that's not possible because of zoning, that would be good. And then I think finally there are ways of trying to think about analogs to what homeowners gain by owning a home. So homeowners get to deduct the interest, and they have a tax deduction. There have been, there are ways to. There are some states that have renter tax credits. So that basically they are providing a tax credit, just like a homeowner tax credit,
yeah,
to renters, where the kind of 30% of your income is the marker for what you might be allowed in terms, mm-hmm, of a tax credit. And then I think finally, just really, housing policy is essential here. It's not sufficient to address all the needs of poor people who are trying to live in safely and stably. So thinking about other asset building strategies like individual development accounts and match savings accounts and so forth, but also thinking about great increasing access to the sort of fundamental structural things that shape people's ability to be socially and economically mobile. So
yeah,
education, jobs, all of that. That's not the job of the housing department, but it is part of the mix that I think
it's
we
the part of the
consider.
Conversation.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. Commissioner Castaneda, what would you kind of add to that?
The last point makes me think that the thing I've been going around saying to folks is you can't build housing on an island. Right? It can't just be we have affordable housing and you don't have amenities near it. We have parts in the city where it takes 3 buses and 1 hour and 15 minutes to get to the grocery store.
Yeah.
That is unconscionable. And so, again, when we think about the path to home ownership, you don't just, this is not the world we live in anymore, that you graduate college and like we're going to put a down payment on a house. That's not what it is anymore. And so that going through renters and making sure that there is affordable rental housing, I think, is essential to get to that conversation about home ownership. And I think that often it can feel like there's more emphasis on renters than there is on homeowners, but it is very much because without renters, without affordable rental housing, you don't get to the other pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, the bond is over 50% dedicated to the rental family pipeline, the multifamily pipeline in DOH, again, along with the other supports. And so we're really excited about that. And again, it's fundamental to home ownership.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'll just throw out there that is really a congrats to this team at the city and the Department of Housing was part of the bond proposal includes something called green social housing. And I think to speak to the importance of rental housing in this is, as a country, we have not funded affordable housing as an entitlement. The closest we get to that is the mortgage interest deduction, which of course is only for homeowners. We don't have anything, any kind of entitlement sense at all if you need a subsidy to only pay 30% of your income toward your housing. So as a result, every city in this country does not have enough affordable housing, and nor does Chicago. What I love about many things about this proposal is that it steps out of the public subsidy arena altogether, right, which we are utterly overly subscribed for. There's a line out the door every time we have a low-income housing tax credit round, and this says we got to think differently about this and include some public ownership.
Yes.
And so it's the kind of creativity that we need to bring to the table in the context of a country that just does not value affordable housing as it should.
Yeah. Okay, it's time for questions. Thank you all so much for all of this so far.
Sorry?
Thank you. We have a variety of questions, variety of handwriting as well. So in order for me to kind of gather this together, let's start with one pre-question that we got before the panel started online. And I'm just going to open this up to anyone who's able to speak to it. Someone asked, what barriers do Latinos uniquely or disproportionately face to building wealth through homeownership? And what policy solutions do you see to address those barriers? I opened the conversation with some numbers around, it was black and white, right? A lot of this conversation is black and white, but, you know, there's a lot of other types of folks in this city, so, and in this world. Anybody want to give it a go?
I will say that I think having, you know, spent a lot of my time working in Latino communities, of course, there certainly is just the, language and, cultural barriers that I think are sometimes underrepresented when we talk about how do we solve some of the issues of access. I think that these are some very, very real things. I also think that very often, and I don't think this is unique to Latinos, but I think many other folks that are coming from cultures that are not predominantly white have very collectivist tendencies, right? So it's like more than one family member is helping to buy the house. You know, there is a formal structure of a co-op, but I'm sure that many folks out here have family members, right? That like the house was bought between, you know, dad and cousin, and like they've got one floor and someone else has the other one. And I think a lot of very traditional banking has not often lent itself to that. And again, there are definitely folks out there. There's definitely partners in the room who I know are working on that as well and addressing that. But those have definitely been some other barriers that are not often as just basically addressed as you don't have enough money and we can help you get more money.
One thing I'll just quickly add to that, because we do have, as Kamish said, lots of great folks in the room doing this work. But the Resurrection Project, I know, has a long partnership with Self-Help Credit Union on lending for folks with ITIN, Spanish Coalition for Housing, very culturally competent kind of classes as well. So I think there is an importance to digging in around what individual communities need. And if you're in a community where values are low, there's a distinct set of challenges there. And there, if you're in a community where prices are rising precipitously and longtime folks are struggling to save, that's a unique set of challenges. So it's not a blanket thing to solve for. It's quite individual.
All right. Thank you. So this is a question for those who feel that we are in a renter's economy. What is being done in efforts of shifting the economy and mindset of those who may see more of an advantage when renting versus owning a home? What is Chicago doing for as far as incentivizing home ownership amongst young professionals? That might be a question for you, Commissioner, but yeah, whoever wants to.
I don't, first of all, think it's a mindset that needs to be shifted.
Okay.
I think, I don't want to speak. I'll stop there and I'll come back if there's more to say.
Well, I'll say that I don't know that I wholeheartedly would say that is, yeah, what she said. So I think that there are some real challenges to home ownership. And I think for some folks, they want to take those challenges on, right? Again, I don't know about you all. I own. Every time something breaks, it's $10,000, right? Like, my husband keeps trying to talk to me about the furnace. I'm like, man, I don't want to hear it. Like, it's expensive. And I think that it's okay to be super realistic about it. It is also okay for us to work on lowering the barriers so that people can reassess, right? And because I think the thing with with housing, right, and, you know, I talk all the time about housing as a human right, is that people have the right to make choices. And I don't think that there is a right choice or a wrong choice. There's a choice that works for you and your families. And I think as a city, what we are doing is setting people up to be able to make those choices and working for more and to get farther into those equal opportunities and equal resources for everyone. And so I think that there are some folks that will change their mind. If you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have told you I'm never going to buy a house. I was in a family where we had a three flat. My mom is still in this three flat in Logan Square, and we had tenants, and that was hard, and we had bills to pay, and that was hard, and you had to choose between deferred maintenance and paying the mortgage, and that was hard. And so absolutely, I spent years being like, nope, it ain't going to be me. And now I'm like, all right, well, I bought the house, I'm here, you know, we're doing it. And so it did, it changed my mind, but it also, because it changed what resources I had access to. It was changing what I was able to see be possible that had not been available to me, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I'll add, and I liked this phrase, it's in the report, homeownership is a form of forced savings. That's both good, both a positive and can be a negative, I think, to the commissioner's point. Maybe the best thing for you right now, if you can rent at a lower amount and you don't have unexpected $10,000 expenses to deal with, maybe you can use that extra money to save for retirement, to help your kid go to college. And that matters to you today, not 20 years from now when I pay off a house, right? There's no right or wrong answer. I just would echo the comment that I want people to have as many choices as possible. And to the degree choices are constrained, we should be working at opening those up.
I have a follow to this. This is, we're talking about renters, and a lot of these renters are renters who are doubling up, right? These are renters who are, you know, almost living outside, right? People who are, it's a lot of people in one unit, you know, in one space. How are you thinking about, how should we be thinking about homelessness and people who are unhoused entering into the place where they can become renters and then eventually homeowners?
I think they're part of the spectrum and they're part of the steps, right? Part of what we have as a part of our most recent qualified allocation plan is permanent supportive housing units in each of the developments that we are building. And in this last round, we were able to fund 100% PSH project out in the South Side. And I think that for us to be able to say, like, how do we make sure that if you are housing unstable in any way, right? Whether it's you are in a place not meant for human habitation, which is the most basic definition, or whether it is that you're doubled up, that you have an entry point that we're really looking at, again, the lower AMIs and being able to say, you know, these are the things that we're targeting for you. And again, once you're stable there, the world can be your oyster. But we know that without housing stability as the baseline, you're not going to get much further.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into some more of these questions then. So this is a follow to the rental housing stability and policy. Thoughts on just / good cause laws to keep renters housed? Any chance people in this room would advocate for lifting that ban on rent stabilization that you talked about, Rob, at the state to allow for home rule?
Home rule, yeah.
Thank you. Chicago, in Chicago, perhaps, to decide.
So I don't know the history of this. There's Illinois legislation that prohibits the use of home rule in order to establish rent stabilization. I know there's been efforts to repeal that in the past. I don't know what the history of that is. I don't know how much energy there is behind it, but I think it's clearly something that ought to be looked at. I don't know if people have more concrete suggestions here.
I can share that in the first year of the Lightfoot administration, we had a fair amount of conversation about just cause what that means.
Tell me, because I didn't even recognize the word on the page.
Yeah, I mean, it can mean a range of things, but what it can mean in a basic sense, just cause for eviction, meaning that if someone has a year-long lease, and when the lease is up, right now a landlord can say, with appropriate notice, which, by the way, we lengthened from 30 days to 60 or 4 months in some cases, with appropriate notice, the landlord can say, for no fault of anything you did, I just don't want to renew your lease. And many of us have been in a situation where that was the case. You hopefully get the legal notice you need, and you've got to be on your way. Just cause for eviction would say that, in fact, you can't do that anymore, that there would only be very certain reasons why someone's lease could not be renewed. And maybe a family member's moving in, you're deconverting away from rental, et cetera, et cetera. And we took a strong look at that. And what I will say is that we had a fair amount of pushback across city council in parts of the city where there's a lot of mom and pop landlords, and a lot of concerns about what that would mean for them in being a small-time landlord. And so it was not a cut-and-dry issue. It was not a, rapacious, greedy landlords don't want to do it. It was a real struggle to try to figure out something that would address the realities of the different ways that renters and landlords interact across the city, and it did. And as a result, there was not support in council for that to move forward. What we did do instead was increasing the notice that people must get if their lease is not going to be renewed, and we added a right to cure component so that people have as much opportunity as possible to land on their feet if, in fact, their agreement is ending and it's not going to continue.
I'll just say, and I know LCBH is in the room, they are our partner on right to counsel. And so one of the things that is currently happening is that when someone goes and is evicted, they are able to access legal counsel, which is really important. And so I think there's lots of ways in which there is a focus on supporting tenants and making sure that evictions are not happening unfairly.
What would you do to facilitate non-subsidized affordable housing in the private sector?
Green social housing. So again, this is what we are looking at as part of the bond. I really should just retain Marisa to continue to talk about all the work that we're doing. But that was part of the bond. In fact, the bond is actually mostly for existing programs. And on the DOH side, this is the one exception, that we are going to be seeding a revolving fund for green social housing. There are models for green social housing all over Europe, and there are some models here in the United States that we've been looking at. We don't have details yet because we're learning, and in fact, the next thing that we're going to do is put out a more formal request for more information. But we are really looking at how do we partner with the private market to say we can take a stake, we can help alleviate some of the concerns in terms of your financing, and in exchange, we get affordability, and we're really also looking to get it to deep affordability.
The other thing I would throw out with that is something Rob mentioned, which is the Affordable Requirements Ordinance, or the ARO. That is a way that we get affordable rental units in higher income parts of the city without public subsidy. So that's been an important component. It's a hard slog to get those units, and it's, I think a challenge has been that in many cases we're talking about buildings that are predominantly studios and one bedrooms, when in many cases what folks are looking for are bigger units than that, and needing are bigger units than that. But in a lot of cases, if the project's big enough, the number, so if it's 20, we strengthened this law while I was there, so now if it's 20% affordable units, that number of units can be as big as or bigger than an entire low-income housing tax credit deal that we then, as that they then don't have to publicly subsidize anymore.
And I will say to that, right, part of what we've seen, and I'm sure this was starting to happen already while Marisa was there, but in conjunction, ARO in conjunction with the state law around tax breaks for properties has meant that actually the vast majority of units are now being built rather than paying out into the AHOF fund, which is great for the units, bad for what we were funding out of AHOF, but this is part of the reason why we did the bond.
Yeah. Right. So it used to be that you had to, in some way between the two, get to 20%, but now there's a state incentive if you build all 20%. And so good for the city, challenging for finances. But
I think one other dimension here is about length of affordability, right?
Yeah.
So affordable units that are built in with low-income housing tax credits generally are sunset after 30 years. So you're building in affordability for a period of time, but then after that, depending on what happens in the market in these neighborhoods, you're at least open to losing that affordability.
I would say, Rob, that's more true on the ARO side, where you know, these are market rate developers, or for sure these are going to disappear in 30 years. On the low income housing tax credit side, a lot of the time the developers are folks in the room, Bickerdike, the Resurrection Project, and others who will absolutely hold on to those units as affordable. But you're right, that's a definite component. Not just because you create them doesn't mean they stick around forever.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this might be the last one. This is from the perspective of wealth building. Developing modular and other types of starter homes is a major strategy to address the cost of development, but this person says starter homes generate less price appreciation and less equity. Is there a way to build quote-unquote forever homes like the classic Chicago bungalow to promote more wealth building opportunities from affordable home ownership?
I think there's a question of making sure that the folks that we're working with are folks who actually do have that in mind. I think that in a lot of ways, the concept of the starter home it's no longer a real thing, right? I think of all the people who bought, you know, just 4 or 5 years ago, they're like, we'll be here for a little while, and now interest rates are what they are, and they're like, well, I'm gonna be here forever, you know, and that's kind of what happens. And I think that even as we're looking at modular, like we just toured one site where they talk about like the importance of building to making sure that it is a forever home. Because again, going to wealth building, it's about it being an investment. We want it to last, and we want it to be something that you can choose to do what you want with a good product at the end, whatever that means for you, whether it's passing it on, whether it's selling it. And I think that as long as we continue to hold our partners who are doing this work to that standard, I think we can get there.
Anybody want to add to that? I think that's a great, actually, point to end on.
Thank you all again so much.
Thank you, Aaron. Incredibly well done and efficient, especially the extra 10 minutes. Thanks, everybody. We actually added, for so many of these panels, we added 15 minutes because we felt and heard from so many of you that having all these brilliant people in the room, we want to hear more. So thanks for indulging us that extra few minutes today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, thank you, Rob. Thank you, Marisa. Incredible minds here that are formulating, obviously, some incredible, you know, great changes that will just improve Chicago and, as I said, become a model for the future and for the rest of the country. So, you heard it here at City Club, folks. We're going to be back soon. You all are of course welcome back anytime. Great moderating again. We appreciate that. Crown Family School, thank you again, Adrian, Deb, and your whole team. I know there's so much more to come, and we hope you'll join us again. As I said, Friday, we've got a program. Check our website. Lots more coming, and we appreciate your ideas as well to have these discussions. So enjoy this beautiful summer Chicago day, and hope to see you back here at City Club soon. Thanks.